Good morning, everyone. Continue on our discussion. So we've called... We're all good? We've called the series Managing Feelings, but the truth is, obviously I'm doing it in the context, and I've dedicated this series, this term, to the situation that we have, which is ongoing, and we're all going through it. I saw a beautiful little video of a young girl speaking about Israel, and she said, I'm not on Israel's side, I'm not pro-Israel, I am Israel. I thought that was very beautiful. I think that's true for all of us. We're not here to support Israel. We're Jewish. We're Jewish, and we're all one family, and we're all connected to the land of Israel. So as we continue to go through this, this is our challenge, which is why, as I mentioned, we need to do two things. Now, we're going to get to the topic in a few minutes, but we need to do two things. I saw an article by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg. I don't know if any of you are familiar with him. He's an extremely successful rabbi in Florida, Boca Raton Synagogue. Huge. He's got an amazing network of programs and stuff. And he writes articles, and he has a weekly thing. And he wrote beautifully last week about everything that's going on, and he had a bunch of different points in terms of our response, with each one had like a subtitle, and one of those paragraphs was titled Don't Move On. And he writes, and I'll just quote some of it. He said, obviously no one in Israel, not a single person in the country, regardless of age, location, religious denomination, has been able to return to normal or move on. I mean, we know that there are so many people being called up to fight. Businesses aren't being run properly. Children have been out of school, in and out of school, and so on and so on and so forth, right? So he says, there might have been events or tragedies in Israel in the past that caught our attention. We davened, we prayed, we attended a rally, maybe called a congressman. But then we move on and more or less to go back to normal fairly quickly. And correctly, he writes, this cannot be our attitude right now. Our brothers and sisters have not returned to any semblance of normal, neither can we. It is up to each individual and family to decide how to continue to live life, do what needs to be done, and yet remain acutely sensitive to what is happening in Israel. We must be careful not to judge one another of how we strike that balance. But one thing we can do universally is not to move on. And I think that's a really important point, and I think that we need to keep reminding ourselves. We hope for a miraculous quick end, but naturally, it appears it's going to be a long time. And we do need to strike that balance, but we also need to remember that we cannot just return to normal. The other night, some of you might have listened to the discussion I had with Renee Mill, and she talked about this concept that, of course, we need to remain functional. And if we completely obsess ourselves with what's going on, we'll burn out and become dysfunctional, which will then mean that we're no help to ourselves, to anyone else, and not to the people of Israel either. So there's a lot we can do by remaining focused, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But we do need to strike a balance, it's true. So we have to have what she called the three R's, the rest, routine, and relationships. And we do need to do some normal things, but at the same time, we really need to be, our mind and our hearts particularly, have to be on what's happening. Just to share with you a little incident that I experienced myself last Friday night. This doesn't normally happen, but I had a table full of guests that, like, almost everyone came from a different country. It was like the most bizarre thing. We had two American women, through my daughter's friend's mother-in-law was traveling here with a friend of hers, landed at my table. They were real Americans. A girl from Russia. A boy who I picked up in shul. I happened to be in a shul, and it was someone who was a boy from Germany. He grew up in this little small town in Germany. Jewish guy who was looking for a shul and found it on the internet. I was the central last Friday night. And then, so I ended up taking him home and a bunch of other people. It was really, really, really interesting. Australians. No, it just happened. It doesn't always work out that way, but normally it's more planned. This time it just evolved. We started off with a couple of guests, just evolved to. Anyway, it was fascinating. And we went around the table and people spoke about Jewish life in different parts of the world. But actually, because some of the people were, particularly the real Americans, Floridians, it was actually fun. At the beginning we said L'chaim for all the soldiers and people of Israel, and we obviously focused some time on that. But almost in the beginning felt a bit guilty, but it became, it was hilarious. We were just laughing nonstop. It was very, very funny. And when I went home, it was like late, almost 12 o'clock. I turned to my wife and I said, you know, it's a really interesting thing. It's the first time in 2 weeks that I've laughed. Because I think we all afterwards were such in shock. And I realized that actually it was important. But comes with a potential price, right? So we need to have a balance. In other words, I think the way we need to do, we need to know that we do need to, laughing is an important part of life, and we do need to do those kind of things. We need to be rested. We need to have routine. I spoke about it last week. Dr. Pelkowitz, I quoted from him last week. He talks about it a lot. You know, eating properly and exercising and so on and so forth. But we shouldn't let that just slip us back into completely normal routine and then start to forget about what's going on, because the world is crazy. And we really need to be focused on what's going on and do whatever we can, as we've been talking about and we will talk about, to help the situation. We can't forget about it, particularly because the world is forgetting about it. Actually, not just forgetting about it, they're becoming hostile, which I thought would happen, unfortunately. And we can't forget what this is all about, right? Even though the world wants to move on from it, but we can't forget that whatever it was, almost 3 weeks ago, on the 7th of October, the most unimaginable pogrom, that's what you need to call it, what it is, happened in our own land, right? And that's just unbelievable. And so many people are affected, thousands and thousands and thousands. We have hostages in Gaza, and we have chayalim and chayalot, soldiers, men and women, who are fighting and putting their lives at risk. So, if we do that successfully, and back to the topic, if we do that successfully, then we will be thinking about it. And what will inevitably happen is that we'll experience some difficult emotions, which is what's been happening and what could continue to happen. And we have to deal with that. So one way to deal with it is to escape, but we can't escape and go into denial. We have to be focused. And therefore we will, a range of emotions, and we will, as we talked about last week we talked about worry. We will experience a range of difficult emotions, and we need to confront them. And we need to manage them, and we need to channel them into something positive. So that's why I was just saying that this series, this week and for the next few weeks, we just need to come together. Coming together is a good thing anyway. We need to continue to remind ourselves not to forget. We need to continue reminding ourselves to maintain the amazing Jewish awakening that is happening throughout the world, including here. It's the most amazing thing. People are just coming forth and wanting to do things. We've had people just walk in, they want to just buy a mezuzah, for example. They just want to put another mezuzah on their door. Yesterday, my son got a text from someone we both met, I don't know how many years ago, we'd sort of lost contact. Where can I buy a mezuzah? Wants to write Shabbat candles, and my fiance hasn't put on tefillin for 10 years. Can you help him? He's going to meet them on Sunday morning, that kind of thing, right? It's just the most amazing things. We need to continue that on. We need to just, that unity, that oneness that is going on, which is all inspirational stuff. Pride, you know, I've heard from so many speakers, just, you know, listening to podcasts and speakers and videos, the word pride is coming up a lot, which is beautiful. Because we are pride, we have to be proud of who we are. And right now we can be, it's not always the case 100%, but right now we can be very proud of the Jewish nation. They're amazing, right? We have come together in the most amazing and beautiful way. And we need to keep that up. We shouldn't let that disappear. And then we also need to deal with and process and talk about and discuss and explore the difficult emotions that we have and what we do with them. So last week we talked about worry and anxiety. I shared with you a couple of different ideas. One was based on the verse in King Solomon in Proverbs about eliminating and minimizing worry through talking and connecting with other people. We talked about learning to be present, which is very important. We talked about replacing it with something positive. And we talked about the importance of routine. So today I'm going to talk about another difficult emotion. But before I get there, one of the things I've been sharing with you the last few weeks is the importance of sharing inspiration. Just sharing inspiring stuff, videos, stories. I did a few times last week. Today I don't have a PowerPoint, but I'm going to share with you a story. Again, maybe some of you have seen it because things go around and get forwarded. But I just read this beautiful, beautiful article. And again, just the way people are coming and just rising to the occasion, just amazing. So it's written by a woman called Aviva Barbut or something. And she says the following. She says, you can wish me mazal tov. Yisrael and I, meaning her husband, just got married in Jerusalem. You don't know us? No problem. Neither did the 400 or so people who showed up at our wedding on Sunday. And she explains. She says, we're both 40 years old, children from previous marriages, met online, planning to get married next month. My fiancé, now husband, has been in the military for most of his life, and he was called to duty near Gaza. And I felt the urge to marry right away, even if it meant our family and friends could not attend. We talked it through. We decided to have a very, very small thing. All of his friends had reported to duty, so they wouldn't be able to be there. Family was overseas, they wouldn't be able to come. So we decided we'll get married in the offices of the local rabbinate. And then a few days later, he was going to rejoin his unit. In the meantime, he was away from the base. He was only going to get a few days off to come and get married. So she writes, while Yisrael was away at his base, I prepared for what I knew would be a very small wedding. We did not need invitations, meals, or fancy clothes. But one thing I did need was a talit for me to give to Yisrael, as a custom that the bride gives a talis to the groom. But how could I choose a talit? I knew nothing about talits. So I turned to Rabbi Abba Marzel of Chabad and Har Hatzofim, who I'd never met before, and asked him to help me. Within a few hours, he had a talit. Okay. Then on Sunday morning, my son told me it would be wrong to have no party at all. Let's pick up some rugelach and have just like a small celebration with some friends. He insisted. She writes that she was able to invite a few friends, but then she realized that her husband wouldn't have any friends there, so he needed a few men to celebrate with as well, she decided. So I asked Rabbi Marzel if he could perhaps bring a few fellows to join in the celebration and wish us mazel tov. The rabbi posted the request on social media, and I don't even know what happened next. Everyone wanted to come celebrate. They felt it was not just Aviva and Israel's wedding, it was the people of Israel's wedding. Two amazing guys from Ramot, Naveh and Ori, stepped in and helped organize everything, a hall, food, photographer, musicians, and a DJ, all materialized seemingly from thin air. The goodwill of the Jewish people wishing to celebrate with a brother and sister they'd never met. The joy in the hall was indescribable, singing, dancing, hugging, and it went on and on. I felt God's presence with us there in the wedding hall. Beautiful. Okay. So I wanted to discuss today a different emotion, the emotion of fear, which is a legitimate feeling. It's one of the normal emotions. Now, when we say legitimate, as we explained last week, it's not legitimate when we let difficult emotion overwhelm us and stay with us, but it's normal to have fear. And if we're honest, at least some of us, not everyone's feeling the same thing. Different people feel different things at the moment. There is an element of fear which is invading us on different levels. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay. Especially, as predicted, the world is turning against us, as they do in these kind of things, very openly, shockingly openly, actually, in sometimes couched in very sort of flowery, sophisticated, convoluted language, which is not hard to decode. What happened yesterday with the Secretary General of the UN is just unbelievable. What a garbage institution, to be honest. And, you know, all this nonsense people condemn, but there's always the but. Of course, we condemn all killing, but. Talk about the cycle of violence, which I like to call the cycle of stupidity. I mean, what kind of cycle of violence, what kind of equivalence? I mean, it's just really, really bad. Universities are really going crazy, although they're getting some backlash, thank God. Some really huge donors in the States of Jewish donors, very liberal, but you know, Jewish donors, very, very big Jewish donors have pulled their funds from some universities, which is great news. But unfortunately, the lies and the lack of accuracy and just blatant lies just grow from day to day. I mean, it's amazing to see people. I don't watch that much, but I do sometimes, I have to admit, just to see what's going on and just to see them just with a straight face, like just say things which are completely not true. And people feel nervous. I'm sure everyone had, but I had just 2 weeks ago, I was walking down Shabbat afternoon from my house to here, to Shul, for the Shabbos afternoon Mincha, and I had a car stop, and two guys, obviously from our cousins, scream at me, "Free Palestine, free Palestine." Wasn't very comfortable, right? By the way, just on that, when people talk about innocent people, It's important to call out when people gather with what they call a peaceful rally and say free Palestine is a cry for genocide. We should be unequivocal about that, because it always comes from this thing, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which basically means take Israel off the map.
Yeah.
right? It's not a peaceful cry. It's not a cry for freedom. It's not about occupied territories. It's not about any of those things, right? It's not even a debate. Free Palestine means the whole Palestine. That's what they mean. And it's a genocidal call. I mean, that's exactly what it is, right? I mean, not everyone means it that way, maybe, but I'm saying, but it is. Those words are very, very, they're a call for violence, basically, right? And people are in, you know, people are in different situations. I'm sure everyone here is different situation. I had an interesting feeling the other night. Last Monday night, I did a session for a big group of young adults in someone's home. We talk about managing our emotions and going through this time, and I saw people are struggling. And it was interesting, in the beginning, I asked them just to express some of the feelings that people are feeling. People said shocked and anxious and that kind of thing. And then one person said lonely, and I didn't know what she meant. And I said, what do you mean lonely? She said, yeah, at work. And then I realized, you know, I work at Bin all day, so I'm working with a few like-minded people, right? But it's not the case for everyone here. It's not a place for particularly young people. And for some people, it's becoming uncomfortable. Might not be dangerous, but it's becoming uncomfortable. People ask questions. People are brainwashed by the media and so on and so forth. So social media particularly. So I guess what I'm trying to bring out is we can understand that for many people, there is an element of fear that's starting to set in. You know, we still feel relatively safe here, but there's that uncomfortableness, there's unsettledness. And so it's legitimate, right? The fear is legitimate. However, we also need to know, of course, that fear, as we know, is a difficult emotion. And intensely, it's a destructive emotion, right? It can be very destructive, it can be paralyzing, it can be debilitating, and it's not a good thing. So what do we do about it? That's the question. What do we do about that feeling? If we are feeling that element of fear, how do we manage that? How do we channel that, right? And we have to confront it, and we have to do something with it. Otherwise, we become stuck, right? That's what fear does to people. Fear makes people stuck. So we have to also understand what we mean when we say fear, right? So a number of years ago, I don't know, some of you might remember, I did a series on fear. At that time, it was based on a book by someone called Susan Jeffers. I've forgotten the name of the book. And she talks about intervention. She talks about how to reframe the mind, educating the mind, she calls it, and so on. But it's important to realize when we start off, and that this came from her book, really, that there's two types of fear. And we need to understand what we're talking about, right? There's fear that people have. There are a lot of people that have fear. But they have fear from things that are more in control. So, for example, things like people have a fear of making a decision, right? People have a fear of making a mistake. People have a fear of public speaking, right? Those are some kind of fears that we have in terms of life routine, in terms of regular things that we do in life. And some people are very scared, right? I mean, like fear of public speaking is a real fear, right? People get up and they freeze. They don't know, can't say a word, right? That kind of thing. That's a very, very different kind of fear than the fear we're talking about. Fear we're talking about is about things that we're actually not in control of, right? Potential attacks or things like that, or even in personal people life, like fear of people getting sick that people have, right? That's a lot. Those are things we don't have actually immediate control. So the things that, like making decisions and public speaking and those kind of things, it's a different intervention. In other words, those are things you can confront. So they talk about people take their fears head on. One of the strategies of confronting fear is to learn to become decisive and just go with the fear. So I'm going to make a decision, I'm going to live with it. You learn to do that. Learning, like getting up and public speaking, making a fool of yourself if you have to. But that's right. So and then it minimizes the fear. And that is one strategy that people use. That doesn't help here. That's not, it's a different type of fear. It's coming from a different source, right? So the things that we don't have control over, we have a different approach, and we need to know how we live with that fear. We can minimize the fear, we can increase our trust in Hashem, our faith, but what do we actually do with that emotion when we can't actually just do, we can't do something that counters the fear, if you know what I'm saying, right? So, in dealing with fear of things that we have little control over, so there's a number of different approaches. I want to just share with you some thoughts, different thoughts. Some of them are more psychological, some of them more spiritual. All of them have to be there. We have to combine all of them and so on. So the first thing that we learn to do just from a psychological point of view is something that Renee mentioned the other night as well, but we actually did it once, a whole series did it as well. Learning to live with fear. So there's a a very famous therapy, a model of therapy in psychological terms called ACT, which is acceptance commitment therapy, right? Different a little bit to CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. The difference between the two is the following. So there are some times where you can, I'll give you an example. So you're feeling upset with someone because they did something to you, right? So there, you can actually get rid of the emotion of being upset. Why? Through a cognitive process. In other words, you can reframe. You can actually sit down, what am I upset, who am I upset with, what's the cause of the upset, right? And then analyze, is that cause legitimate? In other words, you think the person really meant to upset me? Maybe they didn't. Maybe I could talk it through with them. Maybe, right? Maybe they actually, they just did something and I misinterpreted it. So it might have been my interpretation. And then you can go through a process where actually you realize that actually that was a bit of a silly thing. Or my famous example, someone cutting you off on the street, right? I mean, you get upset about it. Maybe they didn't mean to. Maybe it's there for a reason. You can cognitively process this to a way where you can get rid of it, right? That's the, you know, very simplified form, the concept of cognitive behavioral therapy, where you reframe the situation, you reframe the cause, so you look at it differently, and therefore you're able to minimize the fear. But then there are sometimes you have emotions that you can't do that with. Like the fear we're talking about, there's no way to reframe it. It's coming from a place where there's pure evil in the world. The world is a pretty negative place at the moment in terms of the people around us. A lot of people don't like us, particularly in university campuses and in big organizations like the UN and all that kind of stuff. People are spewing hatred. There's protests of hatred all over the world. So you can't reinterpret that. It's evil, right? And it is a legitimate cause of some feeling of being unsettled. So in the ACT model, what you do is something completely different. You learn to live with that fear. You learn to function. And if you remember, it was Russ Harris that wrote that book on ACT, where he talked about different methodologies and how you actually do that. And that great analogy that I always love to come back to, it's a very relevant analogy where he talks about a bus driver who's driving and there's a lot of noisy passengers at the back, right? And they're distracting him from his driving. It's difficult to drive as they're getting on. Now he has a couple of choices. He happens to be on a highway. He can't stop and get rid of those passengers, right? So you can learn to drive with the passengers there and not be distracted, right? And there's different ways of doing that. Like you learn to localize. Where am I feeling the fear? The fear is one thing. I can dedicate even some time to maybe process it and to feel a bit scared. But I learn to continue life. I learn to function. And I learn to keep going, realizing that I am not consumed by the fear. The fear is a small part of me. I still have so much in my life that I can do that is not connected to that fear. There's so much that I need to do. There's so much that I can accomplish. And therefore, you learn to sort of localize the fear as a noisy passenger, and I'm the driver. I'm actually ultimately in control, and therefore I'm going to keep going. The fear necessarily doesn't go away, but at least I'm learning to function with the fear there. Part of that is also mindfulness. Part of that is mindful living, to learn to be present. As I said last week, some of these emotions are more about the future or the past. They're not about the actual moment that we're in. So again, the same thing we said last week, if we learn to just focus on what we need to do now, ask ourselves a question, what am I doing now? So That's the first point, and the first strategy, and the most important strategy on a practical level. Again, understanding that the fear is legitimate if we have fear, but we need to get on top of it. We need to take control, live with it. And it's not only fear that's true. There's a lot of things. Sometimes, for example, people, this is true also when people, we've talked about this before, when people go through a very painful experience, right? So someone, God forbid, loses a loved one in tragic circumstances. That pain never goes away. The only thing you could do is, it's not like CBT where you can get rid of the emotion. You can't get rid of that pain. You can learn to live with the pain and to be productive and give meaning and purpose to life with the pain, not getting it right. So there's a lot of emotions like that. Fear with things, especially with fear with things that we can't really control, would be an example of something that we learn to live with the pain. We put it to a side. It's a noisy passenger on the bus and we drive the bus. But we also need to explore it from a different angle as well. And the second point I want to make is that actually, if you look in Tanakh, if you look in our scriptures, if you look in the Pesukim, the stories of Avatara, we'll see that many people had fear. Even great people, right? Which is comforting in a way, so we're not the only one. Great people had fear, but yet learned to overcome it with moving forward. One of the great examples of this, number of examples, is a story that we're going to read in a few weeks' time. And I'm going to share with you the story now and then come back to it a little bit later. There's a story of Jacob, our patriarch Jacob, Yaakov, right? Who spent 20 years in the house of Laban. And then he came back. He had run away because he had an issue with his brother Esau, right? Esau, the wicked Esau. And he had to run away from him. But then he came back 20 years later, but then he had a whole family. He had married Rachel and Leah and so on. And then he sent messengers ahead to find out if Esau had calmed down yet after 20 years, right? And the message he got back is, Esau is coming to greet you with 400 soldiers. Okay? So he needs to do something about it. And our rabbis tell us that he was... he had to strategize, so he did three things. He sent presents ahead to Esau to calm him down, a lot of presents. He developed a military strategy where he developed his whole family and servants and things into two camps. It was the whole military. And he prayed. Side note, by the way, which I just want to mention because I think it's important and relevant in a time like this when people talk about things. A side note, the Pasuk says a very interesting thing. It says, Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo. Yaakov was very afraid, fear, and he was distressed. So the commentators and the Talmud says, what's the difference between fear, he was scared, and distressed? And they say an amazing thing, by the way. This is not what I actually want to bring out from the story, but it's a very important point to bring it out. To bring out anyway. So Rashi brings us down as well. Rashi says, Vayira, he was afraid that he might get killed. He was distressed that he might have to kill. Right? Because if he was going to have to defend himself, he would. And he might have to kill. Right? I'm bringing that out because that's an incredibly important point that people often confuse. And I think people nowadays find it very difficult to hold opposite thoughts in the head at the same time. Right? Which is I think it's a thing of our generation. Because things are a lot more nuanced than just one thing, right? In the Jewish tradition, starting from Yaakov and even before that, we never, ever liked to kill. Yaakov didn't want to kill. He was distressed that he might have to kill. He wanted to avoid killing. Right? We don't like killing anyone, even a bad person. Because it's God's creation at the end of the day. Right? However, killing is sometimes moral. Bad, but moral. You're upset to do it, but it's moral. Right? And that's what the world doesn't understand. But we have to understand it. Our army, our IDF, takes every measure to avoid civilian casualties. But they have to do what's the moral thing to do. They have to defend the people of Israel and protect the land of Israel. That's what they're going to do. Will there be casualties? Yes. Are we happy with it? No, because Jewish people don't glorify death. By Yetzer lo, Yaakov would kill if he had to. He didn't have to at the end. But he would. He would kill if he had to. But by Yetzer lo, he was distressed. Okay, so that's just an interesting just side note. But... So two things, you know, at the same time are true. People talk about it, it's so sad. So it is sad. Number one, whose responsibility is it? That's one question. And second of all, it is sad, but it needs to be done. When that's the moral thing to do, it needs to be done. As sad as it is and as tragic as it is. So Yaakov prepares, he's afraid. There's a question in the commentaries, why he's afraid? Because God had actually given him a promise that he would protect him. And he was afraid, and it's an important point, he was afraid more from himself. Because he was afraid that he wasn't deserving. Interesting. So even though he had gotten a promise from God that it'll be okay, when he left for Labban, God told him in a dream that he would protect him, he would bring him home to his father's house, and so on and so forth. He was still afraid, and it's brought down almost in some midrashim as a criticism of Yaakov, why he was afraid. He should have just gone with the trust in God completely, but still afraid. Well, if Yaakov be afraid, we can also be afraid, right? It's not a criticism on us. We certainly not on Jacob's level. And then what happened is, he set everything in motion, he set up his camp, he sent the presents ahead, and they crossed over a little river, and they were about to thing. And that night, there's a famous story in the Chumash, where Yaakov encounters, it says, Ish, a man, an angel, it's not quite sure who that man was. And he wrestled with that man the entire night. Now, most commentaries say it was an angel of Esau, and like it was part of the fight. Part of the destiny. He was going to wrestle with him the whole night. At the end of the night, he got injured. Yaakov, his thigh got injured, but he won. Right? He did not let the angel overpower him. But there's a very interesting comment Rabbi Sachs brings this down. It's a very, very interesting comment from one of the commentators of the Chumash called the Rashbam. He was a grandson of Rashi. And he says that the person who he wrestled with was actually a symbol of God. So it's like he wrestled with God. What does it mean, he wrestled with God? And we find this throughout history. Who else wrestled with God? Moses. Moses was the burning bush when God asked him to go to Egypt and become the leader of the Jewish nation. And Moses was afraid. And he wrestled and argued with God for 7 days. I don't know if you know this. He stood at the burning bush for 7 days arguing with God until God lost a bit of patience with him. Right? He didn't want to go. And God said, you're going. You can do it. And therefore, the Yaakov story also was about the wrestle. Can I overcome Esav? Is this going to... I'm scared. Can I overcome it? Moshe Rabbeinu was scared. Jonah was scared. The story of Jonah, as we read on Yom Kippur, he was scared to go to the city of Nineveh. There is a fear. There's an anxiety. But the story of the Tanakh and the story of the wrestle of Yaakov and the angel is that Yaakov overcame. And that was a symbol for him to go there with confidence and confront Esav. Right? It's a story of our destiny. It's a story that we will overcome. Yes, of course we have fear, but we need to tackle the fear from inside. So what we think we're afraid of, right? What we think we're afraid of is something from the outside. And that something from the outside is real. The countries are real. Terrorists are real. The threat is real. So obviously we have to do the responsible thing and we have to do what we need to do, just as Jacob did. We have to prepare militarily. We have to prepare spiritually. We have to do everything we've done. But once we've done what we need to do, and once everyone does in their way and in their role what they need to do, we need to start working on our inner fear. And that's true with us as well. We need to be able to walk proud in the street. We need to know and build our bitachon, build our trust in God and build that courage of God, right? And not be afraid, as the commentaries say in Jacob's case, not be afraid of greatness. Not be afraid of understanding that we are God's nation. And that God has faith in us. And that ultimately, God will save us. Right? That's an important thing to work on. It's an important thing. That's an antidote to fear. So yes, we have fear. We know to live with the fear. And that's what we talked about before, the ACT model. But we also have to work on our fear within. A lot of the fear is our own insecurity. Like, everyone's against us, so we really going to be able to pull through this? I mean, to the point where someone asked me a question the other night. Someone asked me a question the other night in this group. I don't remember who it was, but she said to me, you know, I'm Israel, I'm part of the Jewish nation, I believe, and of course I'm supported with Israel, I am Israel, and so on and so forth. But she turned to me, she says, what's your conviction that actually we're going to survive this? Which was the first time I've heard that question. It was like quite shocking. It also indicated to me what the level of anxiety is, what the level of fear is, right? So let me share with you two things on that. Just again, working on our inner fear, right? Our own personal insecurity, spiritual insecurity. First of all, there's the famous father of positive psychology, Martin Seligman, wrote a book which we once dealt with in one of our Thursday morning series called Learned Optimism, right? We need to become an optimistic people. We need to turn our whole thinking to become much more positive. Again, it's legitimate to have fear. It's normal to have fear. But we have to become positive. And he talks today about three P's. Three P's. The one is personalization, meaning that the pessimist is someone who says, it's all my fault. It's me. It's just always me. You know, I'm just a loser, everything. I never get kept with a job, but always, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? It's always me. The optimist says, no, it's not always me. It's some things happen that are hard. There are hard things that happen. Nothing to do with me. And I think even in a global sense, that's true. Sometimes we personalize, you know, it's our fault, and where was Israel, where was the intelligence? It's all stuff that they'll deal with eventually. But things happen, and through history, this thing happens, and that God allows to happen, and we don't know why, we have no idea. And so on and so forth. But we shouldn't personalize it. It's not about, we are Am Yisrael. And we are eternally. There's a midrash that says that no matter what the Jews do, Banai Haim, they are my children forever. They are eternally my children. Right? The second is pervasiveness, he says, the second P. And that is the belief that when something goes wrong and something doesn't look good, it's gonna affect everything. So we just catastrophize. It's everything means no good. There's no place to run. There's no place to go. There's no place to run from my own fear, from my own sadness. It's just, that's it. This is me now. It's all doom and gloom. Very bad strategy. We have to work on that. It doesn't have to be. Fear is true, but we have to localize the fear. Yes, we have fear, but it doesn't have to it doesn't have to overrun us. It doesn't have to overwhelm us. And the third piece, permanence. Right? We think, that's always going to be. It's not permanence. This is a very temporary thing. Long, maybe, but temporary. Right? So that's just in the terms of emotional stuff, in terms of understanding our just working on our optimism, right? But if you take it just on a deeper level, on a spiritual level, going back to that question a person asked me the other night. So I said to her, I can't really answer that question rationally, because it's what I believe. It's deep. It's a deep faith. We are Am HaNetzach. We are eternal nation. And that's been the case, and it always will be the case. We are not going anywhere, right? We are here. We are eternal. But if you want to have some rationale to it, just look at history, right? We have to look at history. And if you look at history, we will know, and it's just a very rational thing. We are as a people of the Jewish people and the Jewish with the connection to the Jewish land, we are a statistical miracle. Completely. I mean, this has been written about a lot, right? We have gone through very tough times. We have been threatened by destruction by many empires, whether it's been the Spanish Inquisition, whether it was the Crusaders, whether it's the Holocaust, whether it's the story of Purim, when the entire Jewish nation was threatened to be eliminated, whether it's the story of Mitzrayim, and all those kind of things, right? But we're still here. And I saw an article from a guy called Daniel Gladstein, and he makes a very, very important point. He tells a story of his father in the Warsaw, and his grandfather in the Warsaw Ghetto, all kinds of things, right? And then he says the following. He says, what we learn from all these stories, not just that we miraculously survived. This is an important thing, right? Again, building up our inner spiritual confidence. What we learn from these stories, he says, is that God wanted us because he wanted you because he saved your ancestors, right? And every single time something, we go through a difficult time and we pull through sometimes very, very miraculously, it's not just that we miraculously survive, it's that God, so to speak, is investing in us. And he's saying, I won't say the need, because God doesn't need anything, but he wants us, and it's important to him that we keep going. And the more down the line we become, the more down the generations we are, the more important that becomes. In other words, we've gone through so many different ups and downs throughout history, and we're still here, and we're still thriving. God obviously really wants us. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, a great sage in a few generations back, wrote, he said that when I look at what the Jewish people, he wrote, he was a very, very great man. He said, when I look at what the Jewish people have gone through, thousands of years and we're still here, I marvel at this wonder. It is much greater to me than all the miracles that God performed for our ancestors in Egypt, in the desert, and when they first came into Israel. Yes, there were plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea, amazing things. But we are a miraculous people. Why I say that is because we need to really understand that and internalize that, because it's so important for us to understand that we are not defined by the natural process of the world. Because right now, the natural process of the world looks very gloomy. The amount of people that are saying things against us, the amount of people that hate us, the amount of anti-Semitism that's on the rise, the very, very sort of unsettled situation in Israel, and so on and so forth. But we've never been defined by a natural process. Other empires have, and they disappeared when it was time for them to disappear. But we haven't. That's just a fact. That's a miraculous DNA issue of the Jewish people. So we're not going anywhere. Says an amazing thing in this article. He says, you know, we have one day of mourning in the Jewish calendar called Tisha B'Av. Right? It's the saddest day in the calendar. We fast, we mourn the destruction of the temples, we mourn in the prayers we say that day, we mourn the destruction through the Crusades, through many, many different tragedies that happened through Jewish history. And yet, there's a very bizarre thing with Tisha B'Av, that somewhere in the Megillat Eicha, in the Book of Lamentations, which is the book that we read on Tisha B'Av, it refers to Tisha B'Av as a mo'ed, as a festival. Which is, it's not a festival, it's a day of tremendous sadness, it's a day of mourning, right? And it has halachic ramification. There's certain things we don't do on Tisha B'Av because it's called a festival. Like there's a part of our prayers called Tachanun, where we confess our sins and so forth, which we don't say on Shabbat, we don't say on festivals, we don't say on happy days, and we don't say on Tisha B'Av either. And he says, I mean, that's ridiculous. It's a day of mourning. Why are we calling it a festival, right? And he says, because the festival of Tisha B'Av is the festival of our survival. It's that ability to look at Tisha B'Av and look at all the terrible things that happened, but also to look at the fact that we've emerged, that we're still here, and stronger. And that's why we don't, that's why it's called a day of festival, right? And then going back to that story of Jacob and the angel. So many commentators say that Jacob wrestled with this angel the entire night. And that angel was the angel of Esau, right? And in fact, and it says, Vayavek, he wrestled with him the entire night and he got injured. Oh, the only thing the angel was able to do is slap him on the thigh, and he got and Yaakov got injured and he limped for a while until the sun came out and the sun shone and the sun healed the injury. That's what the Torah tells us, right? And there's a couple of interesting points that come from this episode. One of them is a different, also I think is highlighted by Rabbi Sachs in a different article, where at the end of the night, it's a very bizarre thing. Yaakov is wrestling with this angel the entire night. The angel is threatening him and threatening his survival, and he eventually wins him. Then the angel says, okay, my time to go back to heaven. You've got to let me go. And he says, no, I'm not letting you go until you bless me. Barcheni, bless me. And the companies say, what kind of business is this? He's been fighting an enemy all night. I mean, unless we take the interpretation that I shared with you. But the simple reading is, he's fighting with an angel that's trying to destroy him. He says, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And he did bless him. That was the time where the angel changed his name. In fact, it was that angel that changed. Well, obviously it was a godly instruction, but he changed his name from, and then God, that's what I'm looking for, God confirmed it later. But he changed his name from Yaakov to Israel, right? That was the blessing. And I've shared with you before that the two names of Yaakov and Israel, Yaakov is when the Jew is downtrodden, Israel is when we up. So what's going on there? What was going on with this was the following, that Yaakov, he said, I'm not letting go till you bless me, which means that I'm not letting this go until I understand and internalize that there is a deep blessing in even in the greatest tragedy. The blessing is that we're going to turn from Yaakov to Israel, that we're going to emerge stronger. That's the blessing. And we have to know that that's part of the process now. We need to absolutely believe and overcome that fear by knowing and by trusting that, yes, of course there's what to be afraid of, but we're not defined by the natural process of the way the world works. And also we are going to come out of this stronger. And yes, sometimes we're injured, and Yaakov was injured, and sometimes injuries are great. But to take it to the question of how do you know we're going to survive this, there's no question. The night will come to an end as it did with Yaakov. The night comes to an end and the sun begins to shine. That's what happens. And these are the things we need to think about, because we can't change those threats. It's not the type of fear that we can change, but we can change ourselves. We can change our thinking. We can change our positivity, and we can believe in who we are. We can believe in our identity. And just to make that point even stronger, I'm going to just share with you something very beautiful I heard yesterday. On this week's parasha, the parasha we read in Shul is coming Shabbat. So this is a parasha called Lech Lecha, where the whole Jewish journey begins, actually, right? So the first two, after Simchat Torah, we start to read the Torah again. And of course, we begin with Bereshit and the creation of the world, the flood, the Noah, and so on and so forth. And then 20 generations later, it's the first two parshiyot in the Torah I'll cover like 2,000 years, like quickly. And then all of a sudden it slows down, and Abraham comes on the scene, and then everything starts to slow. We're told it in great and slow detail. Why? Because Abraham comes, that's the beginning of the Jewish story. And he's told to go to Israel, Lech Lecha, and so on. And in the middle of the parsha, there's this incredible story where Abraham wages a war. It's not such a famous story. So people, you know, every parsha has its like halal stories that everyone knows, but then there's like the ones that get hidden for some reason. So there's the famous battle between the four kings and the five kings. Okay. And what happens, the four kings win, they overpower the five kings. I'm talking about all kings in the land of Israel. Like, every region had its king. Like, there were 31 kings at one point in Israel. Tiny Israel, like 31 kingdoms, so to speak. So the four kings win over to the five kings. Although the four kings was very strong. A very strong and powerful force. And they won. In the process, they captured Abraham's nephew. Lot, right? Abraham decides that he's going to free him. He needs to free his nephew. Now, I should tell you that the nephew was Lot. I'm not going to go into great detail, but there was a very great symbolism in freeing Lot, because Lot, at the end of the day, became the ancestor of Moab. It's a whole story, because he had to run away from Sodom, was destroyed, lived with his daughters. A whole very complicated story, but at the end of the day, Mashiach comes from Lot. It's one of the ancestors of Lot. Okay. So, in other words, he's capturing Abraham is beginning the Jewish journey, but he's got to capture the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people, right? He's got to re-free the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people. So the Pasuk tells us a very strange thing. Pasuk says that he gathered, by Yarek et Chanichav, he gathered 318 soldiers. Right? 318 soldiers. And then it makes mention of his servant. Avram had a servant called Eliezer. And he went with Eliezer, and presumably these 318 soldiers, and they waged the war the whole night, and Avram Avinu was victorious, surprisingly so, against the four kings, the strongest side of the conflict, and he freed Lot. He took him back. Rashi, not on Rashi's own thing, but Rashi quotes a Talmud or the Medrash, that in fact, he didn't wage war with 318 men. He only waged war with Eliezer. It was Abraham and Eliezer. Listen to this, a little bit of Hebrew you need to know here, but it's very fascinating. So why does it say in the Pasuk there were 318 men? It means he went with Eliezer, who was a great warrior and a faithful servant of Abraham. And Eliezer, the word Eliezer in Hebrew is the gematria, and every word in Hebrew has a numerical value. So the word for Eliezer is, that Eliezer has a numerical value of 318. What does this mean? So were there 318 people? Weren't there? What's the significance of Eliezer being 318? What's the significance of the number 318? So it's a very, very long discussion I heard in the shiur. In fact, I'm still listening to the whole shiur, but it's a very, very fascinating idea. Listen to this. There's a word in Hebrew for despair, for giving up hope. Classic word that's mentioned many times in the Talmud on different levels, halachic levels and things like that, giving up hope, right? It's called Yiush. The word Yiush, to give up hope. The word Yiush has also a gematria. What's the gematria of Yiush? 317. Right? Eliezer, his name was the gematria of 318. Now, what does the word Eliezer mean? Eliezer comes from, because we know this later on in the Torah, Moses called one of his children Eliezer. Because he said, when I was in difficult times, Eli is God, my God, Ezer, he helped me. Right? So Eliezer is a symbol of God's help, God's intervention. So Eliezer is about God helping us. It's about the assistance of God. And it's 318. It's when you don't despair. When you don't give up hope. And that's what the Torah tells us. Abraham went and waged this war with 318 people. Who were the 318 people? It means he waged this war by refusing to give up hope, by refusing to despair, by refusing to be scared. Why? Because he knew that maybe in the world of Teva, in the world of nature, there's what to be scared about, and it's legitimate. As I began with today, we look around, there's legitimate sources of fear. But he knew that would induce the concept of Yiush. That would induce the number 317, which is the term for Yush, for giving up. But at the same time, Avram said, I refuse to give in to you. I refuse to despair. The despair is the worst ingredient in terms of survival. I refuse to despair. I'm going to rise above the word 317. I'm going to rise above to the number 318. because Eliezer, because I know God is on my side. And we need to learn that, we need to understand that. So of course, coming back to summarize the whole thing. Of course we need to do what we need to do. And of course it's normal to be scared, and that's okay. But we have to work on it. Psychologically, emotionally, learning to live with fear, learning to be, not to recoil, not to stop living, not to give our enemies the spiritual defeat that they're looking for, not just the physical defeat, by stopping to do Jewish life and stopping to be involved in Jewish life and stopping to be proud Jews. That's exactly what they want us to do. Of course, we need to do the responsible thing, and we step up security, all those things that we need to do. Unfortunately, we do because we live in a world, but we're not bound by this world. So we live in the world, and then we take the responsible steps, but we don't give up. We rise to 318. 318 is above 317. It's above Yush. We stay above despair. Why? Because Eliezer, we know that we are not defined. Our destiny is not bound by the natural routine of the world. We know we are eternal nation. We know that statistically, miraculously, we're still here. And we're going to continue to be here. And we're going to emerge even stronger. So fear is a difficult emotion. It's very difficult. It's hard to... But we need to work from a different side. We need to manage it. We need to live with it. But we also have to overcome it by becoming stronger and more confident within ourselves, within our own Jewishness. We need to continue to stay focused. We need to continue to remember and do what we need to do, just as Yaakov did. Collectively as a nation, we do the three things that Yaakov did. We have diplomacy when that's relevant. We fight when it's relevant. We don't want to fight. We don't want to kill. But we do what we need to do. But we also pray. We pray and we step up our spirituality. We connect. And then most of all, we do what we can. But we believe with absolute faith that we're going to emerge even stronger. That's how we live, and that's how we approach those feelings of fear. We'll continue the discussion next few weeks. Again, let's hope that Bezrat Hashem, it'll be a quick end to all of this so we can go back to normal discussions. But while our brothers and sisters need us, we need to stay focused. Have a great day. Good news.